Welcome to the December 9th edition of Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. We've got a great show. 49 Writers Board President Darn Reardon and author of Raven's Gift, a fantastic book, will be chatting on the phone with us. We'll get a preview of KTOO's very own Thursday's Writer Showcase. Rena Sims will be here to highlight St. Vincent de Paul's Adopt a Family program. We'll learn about how Resource Data Incorporated is partnering with some schools here to teach kids how to program code. And we'll discuss how to prevent winter injuries. All that and more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. World leaders and other dignitaries are beginning to gather in South Africa for Tuesday's memorial service for Nelson Mandela, who died last week. Among those going to the funeral is Canada's National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, First Nations people are among those grieving his death.
The head of the Assembly of First Nations, Sean Antlio, says Mandela was and is an inspiration to people around the world and will continue to be a model of courage and leadership. Antlio is part of the Canadian delegation traveling with the Prime Minister to South Africa. Canada's native people describe Mandela as a crusader for Indigenous rights who believed in reconciliation. Quebec's Council of Crees has also fought on the international stage, and Bill Namagoose, the executive director, says it was an inspiration to him the way Mandela showed no anger to his captors when he was finally freed from prison.
To me, that was a model that you cannot revisit the oppression that we face in the past. We can only fight to have justice in the future.
South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission also served as a model for Canada's residential schools inquiry. Justice Murray Sinclair, who chairs that inquiry, says Mandela understood what Canada's native people have suffered.
He was certainly an elder. He was a person that we saw as a wise man, a wise and kind man, who brought with his presence to this country an understanding of what it was that Aboriginal people in this country were experiencing and had experienced in the past.
As Indigenous peoples, Canada's First Nations say they feel a special connection to Mandela's lifelong efforts and achievements and say they are committed to carrying forward his spirit and his values. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A report by the Indian Law and Order Commission criticizes Alaska. Members of the commission presented findings at a Bureau of Indian Affairs conference in Anchorage last week. The report was recently sent to Congress and the President. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
Commission Chairman Troy Ide, former U.S. Attorney for Colorado, says Alaska's centralized system of law enforcement leaves 70-some villages with no law enforcement presence and others with only an unarmed village public safety officer. He says the solution is to recognize tribal jurisdiction.
Respectfully, we think that Alaska is fundamentally on the wrong track in terms of how it deals with Alaska Natives and with the concepts so important, of sovereignty, self-determination.
Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity says the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act abolished Indian country in Alaska, and resurrecting it would leave non-native village residents with no say in self-governance. But Ide says any time people leave their hometown, they abide by laws written by officials they didn't get to vote for, and the system works because constitutional rights are protected as they would be under tribal jurisdiction. Garrity says the state is doing more to work collaboratively with tribes, hiring more village public safety officers and changing regulations to allow them to carry arms, and it's negotiating with a handful of tribes to create local panels to handle domestic violence, alcohol-related misdemeanors, and juvenile cases.
A local tribunal or a program for them to deal with it right there in the community without going through the state system.
The commission sunsets next month, leaving what comes next up to Alaskan Natives. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
A task force for the U.S. Attorney General is meeting today to address violence and Native children. The public hearing is taking place in Bismarck, North Dakota. Tribal leaders and federal officials are among those attending the meeting. Information gathered will be included in a report to the Attorney General next year. On this day in 1924, the Wupatki National Monument was established in Arizona to preserve Pueblo ruins and other archaeological sites. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting art for the Alaska Native Art Auction, February 20th, 2014, in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event to buy art. Proceeds benefit National Native News. Learn more at kmba.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. He is at the board. And for the weather, periods of snow and rain today, snow accumulation to 1 inch, highs around 35, east wind 10 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy, chance of snow, lows around 29. Tomorrow, rain with snow likely, snow accumulation to 1 inch, snow levels rising to 700 feet in the afternoon, highs around 34, light winds becoming east. Tuesday night, rain and snow. Speaking of snow, Eagle Crest. Powder Magazine has this Ski Town Throwdown, and Eagle Crest is in the finals. It is in the finals. We are there. And for the next 4 days until Friday, at 4 p.m., you could vote for your hometown ski area. All you have to do is go to Eagle Crest. There is a Eagle Crest website. There is a link, and you can vote every day, every 24 hours for Eagle Crest. So let's show some hometown pride and go vote through online. Go to Eagle Crest website and vote for Eagle Crest. And right now, I think, where is it? Who would have guessed that out of 64 ski areas, Eagle Crest ski area would be voted all the way to the final two? So, wow, that's pretty good. Speaking of hometown pride, I am really excited about our first guest. Don Reardon is the board president of 49 Riders, which is a statewide riding organization. He's also a professor at University of Alaska Anchorage, and he wrote Raven's Gift. Raven's Gift is out. It's a pintail book, which is part of Penguin, and it's a terrific read. I read it within the last month, and it is really good. But you don't have to listen to me, because the Washington Post just put it on their top 50 fiction reads for 2013, and I've got Don on the line. Hey, Don, how you doing?
Hey, good to talk to you, Joan, and nice to invade Juno in the afternoon. Hello to everybody.
That sounds great. So you live up in Bear Valley, right?
Up above Anchorage.
And where did you spend your formative years? You were out in the bush, correct?
Yeah. I grew up out on the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska, and a couple of villages around the Bethel area, and then went to high school in Bethel.
Yeah, and all these places have a part in your book, is that correct?
Yeah, the novel's set there. It's I've lived in Anchorage for a while now, but it's still home. The southwest area is home to me, and so that's where the novel takes place.
Yeah, it's a great novel. So the Washington Post review was, "The Raven's Gift by master of the cliffhanger, Don Reardon, is a blend of hunter-hunted, suspensive Jeffrey Household's Rogue Mill, the post-apocalyptic bleakness of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and the haunting mysteriousness of The X-Files." And it's definitely an homage to the Stephen King. It is a great, scary read. How long did you work on that book?
I think I probably worked on it off and on for about a year, something like that. But the reason I probably could have written it faster, I'm not sure. I work kind of manically when I'm writing, so I'll work a whole bunch for hours and hours at a time, and then not touch it for days. But yeah, probably off and on for about a year.
And then I understand that right now that you're writing the screenplay. There's interest to make it into a film.
Yeah, there is. I'm dabbling with the screenplay. I've written several other screenplays before, but this is the first time I get to adapt my own work. And Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I can't talk too much more about it yet, but I can say I've held out to make sure it's filmed in Alaska and back home. And so that's where we're at with it right now.
Well, it definitely reads. It's got a cinematic edge to it. The plot really moves, but there's also that great sense of place and really great characters. So you want to talk a little bit about how the publishing odyssey to get Raven's Gift published?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been crazy. It's just been absolutely maddening. I first started in 2008. It went to editors in the U.S., and I'm fortunate to have an agent, and so he got it into the hands of just the biggest editors, biggest publishing houses in the U.S., and the editors liked it, but they couldn't get it past their publishing boards, and no one took it, and so ultimately it was rejected in the U.S., and then Penguin Canada took it. And then from there, it just went from Canada to Australia and New Zealand, and then the Raven flew over to France for a little while. And then finally, it's finally here in the U.S., 2013, almost 5 years after it went to editors.
Right. It almost seems like 2013 is the year of the Alaskan writer, between yours being your book, The Raven's Gift, being on the Washington Post Top 50 Fiction Reads, and The Snow Child on the Pulitzer Prize shortlist. Actually, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, so on the shortlist. So anyway, it just seems like it's really all about the writers now. And so I'm just curious, you want to talk a little bit about 49 Writers, what that organization does?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do that. We started the 49 Writers just a few years ago as a little nonprofit to kind of help build the literary community here in Alaska for writers and for readers, and offer a sense of community and workshops. With our goal kind of to have workshops statewide for writers at all levels, and that's kind of it's just taken off. I guess we're really filling a niche that people were looking for, and we have lots of members who are writers, and we put on some really amazing workshops, and we've had some great readings from writers from across the country, but also just for Alaskans, and it's been a pretty neat organization to be a part of. And just as a writer, too, it's just nice to writing can be so solitary, you know, you're sitting at your computer alone at night, and it's nice to get to go meet with other people who do the same thing and kind of talk shop and commiserate or share successes, so it's been a lot of fun.
And where can people check that out on the web? As far as it's 49 Writers, you could just search it. And is it 49writers.org?
Yeah, we have the 49writingcenter.org, and that's kind of our main website. But then we also have the 49 Writers blog, which is just an incredible blog full of writers from around the state contributing either pieces of their own writing or writing about writing or experiences with kind of the writing life.
Yeah, I subscribe. I'm a member, and I subscribe, and it's really, really great stuff. I mean, it's pertinent, it's relevant, and it's all really well written, which is really lovely. So that is great. And Don, speaking of blogs, you have a blog, right?
Yeah, I dabble in blogging. Unlike the 49 Writers blog, where we have it updated Monday through Friday, mine's updated quasi sporadically. So whenever I get the itch, or if I do something crazy, like during National Poetry Month, I wrote a poem a day, or I'm posting, it's just kind of random. I'm not at all like some of the people I admire who do it daily.
Don, you had one piece, and I'm not sure if it was 49 Writers or your blog, where you were talking about the process, the rejection process of trying to get your book published. Where was that? That's a really great piece of writing. Where is that? Where can somebody find that?
I wonder if that's – I was fortunate enough to be the keynote speaker for Alaska Book Week, and so I might have – it might be an excerpt of my keynote speech on the 49 Writers blog. Yeah, where I talk – I claim to be an expert at rejection.
It's really –
my forte.
Maybe not anymore, because now that Raven's Gift is out there, as I said, it's a really great read. My husband worked on the Yukon River, and I've been up in the bush over many, many years, and it was just really a great sense of place. And it also really talks about the issues of what's the major obstacles of bush life. And I thought the obstacles and the amazing joy, and so I just, and the history, I just want to say you really did a great job. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I know you like working with kids as far as inspiring young writers. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the bush really shaped you and the things that you like to do now that you're a teacher as well as a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. I was fortunate enough to have a mom who's a fantastic teacher, and that's what brought us out to the bush when I was a little kid. And so as a young boy immersed in the native culture and in Yupik culture, it was just magical to me. And that world of storytelling was fantastic. And at the same time, if I wasn't hunting or outside, then when you're inside, there wasn't a whole lot to do other than to listen to somebody tell a story or to read a story. So I fell in love with reading and writing at a really young age and kind of decided that's what I wanted to do. And then that moved me into kind of starting to take notice that my fellow classmates and peers weren't so excited about reading and writing as they were when they were kids. And then by the time I got to high school, I was pretty much the only one interested in any of that anymore. And so I became a high school English teacher first, and I always had the dream I was going to write, but I was teaching too and really trying to figure out why, where had kids lost that magic and trying to bring that back to them. And so I still try to do that. And I think a lot of it, the sad part is school actually takes the love for reading and writing away from kids. And, you know, it's the rare teacher who gets to give that gift back. And so I try to use the power of reading and writing to inspire kids again. And then I think even in my own writing, I'm still trying to do that a little bit, trying to bring some of the magic of the world, the creative world, back. And then for me, I'm also inspired by Alaska Native stories and the power that those stories have in terms of they're ancient, and there's a power to them about how we can live and how to be human beings. It's kind of embedded in even the just, you know, the little simple scary stories that I grew up with as a kid that I thought were so cool. Now I think they're even more amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And your characters in Raven's Gift, your protagonists, they are teachers that go to the bush to teach. That's correct, right?
Yeah. And I think they're teachers, and they're just a part of the churn of teachers that go into rural Alaska and stay or don't stay. And so I grew up watching this kind of annual tide of teachers come and go, and we stayed. We stayed till my mom retired, and then I went back and taught. And so there's just that turnover of teachers and kind of what that causes on the community that's always kind of weighed on me. And so that's a part of the story too.
Yeah, it's actually a big part of the story. So, Don, we're unfortunately out of time, but I want to say thanks for joining us and congratulations on the book, working on the screenplay, and also being picked as, you know, Washington Post's shortlist of the great reads of 2013. So hopefully you'll be able to come down and do some stuff with 49 Writers down here in Juneau.
Oh, I would love to. I'd love Juneau and love to come down and visit you. And thanks so much. I appreciate the support.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Don. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night. Blackbird. black night.
Hello, we're back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. It is 3:20 p.m. on Monday, December 9th. We were just chatting with Don Reardon. He's the board president for 49 Writers and the author of The Raven's Gift. You could search out his website and his blog and 49 Writers. It is a really great read about Alaska. Speaking of writers and Alaska, I've got Scott Burden in the studio with me. Scott is the arts and culture producer here at KTOO, and he's here to talk about the Writer Showcase, which will happen on Thursday. So what is it? Where is it? And what's the scoopy?
Well, thanks for having me on the show today, Joan. It's great to be here. So the Writer Showcase is a new program, and it's part of our new series called Arts at 360. Now, at 360 is the name of our new production space downstairs. So on the news side of things, we have a series called Forum at 360, and on the art side of things, we have Arts at 360. And so under that umbrella of Arts at 360, we will have various shows, and one of them, one of our first ones, is called Writer's Showcase. And it's this Thursday at 7 p.m. Here at the studio. Doors open at 6:30. We will have holiday treats. It's pay as you can. And for those listeners who are familiar with Selected Shorts, NPR's Selected Shorts, it's going to be a lot like that and televised. And if you're not familiar with Selected Shorts, how it works is that program chooses published short stories and has actors read those pieces. And it's broadcast on the radio. Well, we're going to take that one step further and actually televise it. And we are going to have usually probably 6 to 7 spots. If you think it's a one-hour program, and of those 6 or 7 spots, you know, if you think about an average 10-minute piece or maybe a 6-minute piece, first of all, we're going to ask for all Alaska writers whenever possible. And of those, let's say 7 spots, 4 we're looking for published writers, and then we're always going to keep approximately 3 spots open for aspiring writers. We want to make sure that this program is accessible for folks who are just getting going as writers, and we also want to put in some seasoned writers as well. We're very excited about it.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. So yeah. You're talking about the new 360 studio.
That's right.
How big is that studio?
We think that it can fit up to about 120 people. We'll see. We're still sort of, it's new, and we're still playing around with seating configurations and stage size. It depends how we configure it. The beauty of the studio is folks have been working on it for a long time here at K2 and 360 North. They want it to be a turnkey-style studio where we can get folks in here and pretty much hit the button and do a modern, high definition program real easily with very little setup. There are tons of lighting options, these wonderful high definition cameras, remote cameras. The whole thing is ready to go. So that's the space.
Okay. I have more questions too, just about the space. So you say it's going to be televised. So when and where is it going to be televised?
All right. So, of course, we're going to film on Thursday, right, at 7 o'clock this Thursday. But the first broadcast will not be until this Sunday, December 15th at 7 p.m. on 360 North.
On 360 North, okay.
And then we are also scheduled for Christmas Eve at 8 p.m. And then there's a rerun in the middle of the night. And then on Christmas Day, there's one at 3 p.m. And there's also one at 9 in the morning on Christmas Day. All of this, of course, is available at 360 North under the program schedule.
Okay, great. And then will it also air in the air? I mean, on the radio?
That's right. Jeff, I was going to ask you which day that you're going to broadcast.
I know that answer, actually. It's Monday, December 23rd at 3 o'clock instead of Juno Afternoon. You won't be hearing me. You'll be hearing the stories, which will be nice. So this event is open. It's pay as you can. It's not going to be on the air. It's not going to be live. It's going to be recorded.
Correct.
And then when you say actors, is one actor going to do a piece, or are there going to be a couple of actors reading a couple of
Good questions.
Is it going to be like live radio? Is it going to be somebody talking?
Right. And, you know, under that stencil of what they've done with selected shorts at NPR's, they find that by having actors read other people's work, that the pieces can find new life. And so we're going to experiment with that. We're going to have some actors read and some of the writers will read their own pieces. But among the actors, we have Shona Strausser, Christina Apathy, Ryan Conroe, and am I forgetting somebody? Enrique Bravo will also be reading as part of actors. And we have writers such as Heather Lendy will be reading, Clint Farr, Jeff Kirsch, and a couple of surprises in there, including our very own Joan Pardis.
Which is why I had all these questions, because I really had no idea. I saw that there was a writer showcase, so I submitted something, and Scott said, oh, yeah, this is good. We'll use it, and we're going to have Shauna read it. How does that sound? And I was like, oh, that sounds good. Yeah, that sounds great. But I had no idea what it was, so I'm happy you came in and answered all my questions and everybody else's.
Well, it's a beautiful piece that you wrote.
Thank you.
I didn't know you were such a good writer. I knew you were a good host, but I didn't know you were a good writer, too. And it's
thank you.
I'm really proud to have that be part of the program, and I think people will really enjoy it.
I'm excited to hear what Shauna does with it.
I know, right?
It's going to be really fun. So I love the idea, because I did a Munroot once, and it was very nerve-wracking. I write professionally. I do public relations, but I also have been writing for years. I was a former journalist, and I've been published in magazines and newspapers.
Right.
But finding your own voice after telling other people's stories for a very long time is sometimes for me, it's been very difficult. So I'm just thrilled that somebody else is reading my words.
Oh, well, good. It's a beautiful piece, and I think other people will agree.
Thank you. So who else are your surprises? So you have Heather Lendy, who's coming down from
Haynes,
and Jeff Kirsch, and Clint Farr.
Yep. Perhaps one of the classics will be a piece by Rockwell Kent. Rockwell was born in the end of the 1800s, and he wrote a piece called A Northern Christmas. He was a New York artist, a graphic artist, as a matter of fact, and did graphic design for Moby Dick and some of Shakespeare's republications. Real famous graphic artist, but also an amazing writer. He went and spent Christmas of 1918, I believe, on Fox Island, which is close to Seward. And him and his son went out there, and he wrote this piece about it. They had next to nothing, had a real minimalistic style Christmas. He was trying to get away from all the busyness in New York and just needed some time to find himself as an artist, and wrote this piece that Dave Hunsicker told us about. And it's called A Northern Christmas, and that's the one that Ryan's going to read.
Oh, that's great.
And so, we have this classic piece from Maritime Alaska, and it talks about being on the island and this Christmas without anything, really, except for art and dancing and family. It's just beautiful. So,
and old.
And old, too, right? Classic Alaska.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
So looking forward to it. It's old, new. It's going to be a fun night. We'd love to have as many people out as usual, going to a play or watching a movie amongst other people, hearing the laughter, seeing people cry, the applause. All those things make a live performance even better. So please come out.
That sounds great. So it's Thursday at the studio here at KTOO at 360 North Studio.
Yeah, downstairs.
360 Studio.
Yeah.
And at 6:30, cameras roll at 7, and it's pay as you can. Thanks so much for dropping by.
You're welcome. Thanks, Joan.
And here is the Writer's Almanac from Monday. It's the 9th of December, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet John Milton, born London, 1608, graduated from Cambridge, lived for 6 years at his father's country estate, reading Greek and Latin, writing poetry, hoping, he said, to leave something so written to after times as they should not willingly let it die. Worked as a civil servant, was in politics, wrote pamphlets about divorce and freedom of the press, supported the cause of the Commonwealth during the English Civil War, eventually got arrested, lost his eyesight, spent the rest of his life in seclusion, blind, dictating his epic poem Paradise Lost to his assistants line by line. What in me is dark, illumine, what is low, raise and support, that to the height of this great argument I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to man. It was on this day in 1935 that journalist Walter Liggett was killed in Minneapolis, a murder never solved. He was a Minnesota farm boy, took up newspapering, made a name for himself writing about crime and corruption during Prohibition, bootleggers who paid off politicians, edited a paper called The Midwest American, and he used it to go after the Minnesota mobster Kid Can, Isidore Blumenfeld, a bootlegger, and also Minnesota's very popular farmer labor governor Floyd B. Olson, who Liggett believed was involved with the crooks who ran the liquor operations. Kid Can was a childhood friend of Floyd B. Olson's. It was on this day, 1935, Liggett spent the day at home. He was working on an editorial, arguing for the impeachment of the governor. A snowy afternoon, he and his wife Edith picked up their daughter from the library, ran some errands. He parked in the alley behind their house. He just stepped out of the car with a sack of groceries when a car with two men came barreling down the alley, a machine gun. And they shot Liggett in the chest as they raced past. He died instantly. His wife got a good look at the gunman's face. She said it was Kid Can, but Kid Can bribed law enforcement and witnesses. He was acquitted. Edith Liggett took her children to New York City. Floyd B. Olson died of cancer 8 months later. Kid Can moved to Miami Beach, where he made a fortune in real estate. And it's the birthday of one of the people who helped invent the modern computer, Grace Hopper, New York City, 1906. It was Grace Hopper who helped to develop the computer language known as COBOL, Common Business-Oriented Language, so that ordinary people could write computer programs. Here's a poem for today by Emily Dickinson, I Would Not Paint a Picture. I would not paint a picture, I'd rather be the one, its bright impossibility to dwell delicious on, and wonder how the fingers feel whose rare celestial stir evoked so sweet a torment, such sumptuous despair. I would not talk like cornets, I'd rather be the one raised softly to the ceilings and out and easy on, through villages of ether, myself endued balloon, by but a lip of metal, the pier to my pontoon. Nor would I be a poet, its finer own the ear, enamored, impotent, content, the license to revere. A privilege so awful, what would the dower be, had I the art to stun myself with bolts of melody? Emily Dickinson's poem, I Would Not Paint a Picture. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is Shelley Owens. If you enjoyed the 39th Alaska Folk Festival, you'll want to tune in to Friends and Neighbors this Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. for highlights of the 2013 festival. That's highlights from the 2013 Alaska Folk Festival, this Wednesday night at 7 p.m.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. It is 3:34 p.m. I'm your Monday host, Joan Partis. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. We've got holiday elves in the studio right now. We have Rena Sims and her cohort elves, Paula and Louise from St. Vincent de Paul's Adopt a Family program. Hello, ladies. How are you?
Hello.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much. Let's make it a Merry Christmas for lots and lots of people. We were talking during the break, and you have 250 baskets to fill?
Yes, we do. And 250 food baskets to fill. We have 175 families that have not been adopted yet. We have 60 food baskets that we know of, but we don't have that yet. And so we're looking to Juno, as they did for us so beautifully for Thanksgiving. We fed over 600 families.
Oh, that's great.
We had 600 turkeys and some all the way up until Thanksgiving Eve, and that had the full trimmings, the pumpkin pie, the corn, the string beans, the turkey, the rolls, the bread. Was so many thank yous going out to Northland Food Service and out to Josh McDonald and to Myra Munson. Her husband just stepped in. She was out of town, and he came down, and he met us at Walmart, and he just purchased so many individual people coming to give and kept dropping off, and we didn't have to turn away anybody. And then we had from the doctor's offices, they even dropped off breakfast foods for so many families that didn't have. And we're looking to Juno again this year to make it a Merry, Merry Christmas.
I have a few questions there. That is fantastic to hear how Juno pulled together for Thanksgiving, which Juno's a unique place, and we do that. Yes. But let's talk about the Adopt a Family program. What is it, and how specifically can people help? So it's St. Vincent's de Paul.
Yes.
And tell us about your Adopt a Family program.
Okay, this year we're doing it a little bit different. They sign up as usual for donors to adopt families, but this year we're asking that they would bring in the gifts unwrapped so that we can bring in the families by appointment into Santa's workshops, and the parents can pick out the gifts and wrap them for their children, and the gifts must be dropped off by the 19th.
Okay, so when you say adopt a family and you're doing it differently, so you go and you say, I want to adopt a family, and then you give us, you give someone information about the family, how many family members are in there.
What their likes and dislikes are. If there's a special need, a special absolute, just I want one thing. You know, I want that special Barbie or that football. And then
if I got a pillow pet, I'd believe they're Santa. I don't want a pillow pet. Please don't bring a pillow pet to me. Go ahead.
But then they, and it gives you an opportunity to buy the things. Then you bring it back, and then the family can pick them up and go ahead and wrap them themselves. It truly is them from them, you know, and it gives, dignity and respect. And they can, and we used to do that. Years ago, they would have a big room, and we'd have shelves upon shelves of donated stuff. And then the kids couldn't come. It was only the parents. And then it was like they really pick these things out for their family.
So they're not surprised as well. So if it's already wrapped, so then everybody's surprised when it comes,
yeah,
and it's not from the family. All right, so that's one way to help, that you adopt a family. You go and you pick the family that, you know, speaks to you or that mm-hmm. you could afford, depending mm-hmm. on how many people are mm-hmm. in the family, mm-hmm. and you could go out and buy a gift for each family. Then, of course, there's you probably take good old cash as well.
Yeah,
you take money. In fact, mm-hmm. I did see Jeff throw some money their way during the break. And he didn't really throw it. He uh-huh. gave it to them. He actually threw it. But anyway, and then another way is food. We were just talking about food donations. So you need ham and green beans and corn and fruit cocktails. So if somebody's at Costco
marshmallows
or wherever one shops, Costco, Fred Meyer's, Walmart, Super Bear, Safeway, IGA, I hope I got everybody, that you could just, you know, pick up more of that or just go and say, this is what I want to do. And then when are the hours for people to come by and give you the gifts or the cash donation or the food donation?
So For the cash donation, if you don't want to come in, you can go online and go to svdpjuno.org, or you can Twitter on Facebook. So svdpjuno.org, you can donate that way. You can call 789-5535 and donate that way, too. You can drop a check off through the mail, and you can send it to 8617 Till Street. Make sure you put it for Christmas.
Okay.
And we figure about $50 per child, per family member, anywhere from 30 to 50 per child. And we could appreciate that very much. So as we had last year, we had people Christmas Eve. Both Scott and Martha and myself were giving out until 8 and 9 o'clock. Some people know where I live or know somebody that knows me, and they show up at our house, Paula's house, my house, and we're still giving out. Again, the food baskets are separate than the adopt the family. Some families really don't want gifts. They really are in need of just the plain food, and they are so grateful for that.
And you could just drop that stuff off during business hours most days. Is that true?
One thing I wanted to let everybody know, one thing that we really appreciate is Price Smashers. If they have, you know, just a couple, or if they have a lot, those really, really helped during the Thanksgiving turkey basket.
We needed 14,000 Price Smashers, and this community came forth with that, which really reduces the price of what we have to buy. Mm-hmm. And at the very end, I was 1,000 short, and somebody dropped by 986 Price Smashers. That's a lot of licking and stamping, and also those coupons.
That's
we can't say thank you enough.
That's unbelievable. So they're talking about the Super Bear coupon system called Price Smashers. Okay, so that's the who, what, where, when, and why of the Adopt-A-Family program with St. Vincent's de Paul. So many different ways to help out. There's good old cash or check, there's food donations, and then there's buying gifts. And it's time. It's December 9th, so it's around the corner. Ladies, thank you for coming in, and also thank you for all that you do.
Thank you. Merry Christmas
to
all of you.
God bless you, Juno.
Yes.
This is Bird Note. Chances are good that while many in the U.S. are out counting birds for the annual Christmas bird count, our friends in Latin America are doing the same. At Costa Rica's La Selva Research Station, for example, they're counting both resident tropical birds and those that have migrated south for the winter. These include the wood thrush and the Baltimore oriole. More than 500 species of birds have been documented at La Selva. And though the numbers fluctuate from year to year, many species, especially migratory ones, have declined. Costa Rican birding guide Roger Melendez reflects on one reason why.
We're counting the birds by numbers of species and individuals by the species. So we have some species that were the most common last year, and they are not this year. So who is affecting that? So I think if you have a pet, if your pet is a cat, so cats is one of the principal predators for birds in the United States. So please keep your cats indoors, because I think this is the principal reason why some birds are not really common anymore in Costa Rica if they are coming from the United States.
Keeping your cat indoors. Who knew the positive effect of your action could be felt all the way to Costa Rica? For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Hello, you are listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. It's 3:43 p.m. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. And we have Ursula Sferega here from Resource Data Incorporated. And she's here because this week is Computer Science Education Week. The Hour of Code is the name of this project, and it is a global grassroots initiative with the goal of getting 10 million children around the world to do 1 hour of computer programming. Local software development and IT consulting firm Resource Data Inc., where Ursula Works, has partnered with administrators and teachers at three Juno schools to bring the Hour of Code to 700 students in grades 1 through 8. I know that they are working with Harborview Elementary, Montessori Borealis, and the Juno Community Charter School. Is that correct, Ursula?
Yep, all three schools are participating.
So tell me, how does it work?
Well, actually, it's a really turnkey grassroots initiative. If you go to hourofcode.org or hourofcode.com, it will redirect you to the Computer Science Education Week website. And it was actually started by some very big names. Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, and Bill Gates were the originators of this program. But what it is basically is several dozen online tutorials that are free. Very, very easy to access, along with a package that helps folks like me, community advocates for our industry and school districts, and really just anyone who wants to get involved, help students achieve this 1 hour of programming to really demystify our industry. You know, it's not a black art. It's something that's very accessible to everyone. And this is not just for students. This is for anyone from age 4 to 104, really. But I thought it would be a good idea to get our kids involved here in Juno.
It sounds great. So the 700 kids in the elementary schools, let's say they have some experience with a phone or an iPad or gaming or some handheld or whatever, Xbox, PlayStation, whatever, the millions and zillions of games and apps that are out there. So what are they going to learn this week in the school?
Well, actually, the tutorials they may be masked as fun games, but in essence, what they're teaching are the basics of computational thinking. So the tutorial we've been using heavily this week actually is a program that allows students to solve puzzles using characters from the game Angry Birds. Also, Plants vs. Zombies is another pretty popular one, and Lightbot. And then for the more advanced students, there's a Khan Academy tutorial that teaches children how to draw using JavaScript. So actually, they might be having fun, but we're tricking them into understanding the fundamentals of computer science.
Okay. And so who are the teachers or administrators that are doing the heavy lifting at the school?
Yeah, I really want to give a lot of credit to the Juno School District at large. I mean, what we did was, with the number of volunteers we had, went directly to the principals. So Kristen Garreau of Montessori Borealis, and Dolores O'Mara, who happens to be the librarian. She wears many hats there, but also at Montessori. You know, those two really made it possible. Dolores made sure we got the laptop carts and got the kids organized and worked with the teachers to make the time. And then Dave Stoltenberg really knocked our socks off. I mean, we called and said, hey, you know, we'd like to get one or a couple of your classes involved in this. And he said, couple of your classes? Of our classes, heck, I want to do my whole school. You know, let's do the whole school. I don't want anyone to miss out on that. And so 500 students are participating at Harborview Elementary. And then I was able to drum up a couple more volunteers for the charter school, and they have two classes participating. So all in all, it's been pretty amazing.
And are you popping in during this week?
I am. Actually, 100 of the Montessori students participated last week because of some scheduling conflicts. So, and then today I was at Harborview and Montessori. So far I've facilitated 200 of the 700 students with their Hour of Code.
That sounds great. And what I really like is that Ursula is obviously a female, and she's a young woman here, and it's nice to see a young woman in the tech field.
Thank you. Actually, that's such a hot topic. You know, 57% of bachelor's degrees are earned by women, and just 12% of computer science degrees are awarded to women. This is a really complex topic, but, you know, we're seeing an organic shift in that even in our own Juno branch. And when I started in the branch a couple years ago, we had two other women working for us out of 20. We now are about half women, and, you know, we're nearly 20 employees here in Juno. So I think this is just an organic trend. I just want everyone to know that girls are just as capable as boys of programming, and there's an excellent book called Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, for anyone who's interested in looking into this more.
That sounds great. Ursula, thanks for doing this. Thanks for taking it on, and thanks for working with our kids to get them interested in how those games happen.
Thank you.
And everything else they do on the computers.
We really hope next year we can reach the whole district.
That'd be great. All right. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear about winter safety.
We love to quantify, digitize, take apart, synthesize, remember.
We're back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. We were just talking with Ursula from Resource Data Inc. about the computer code that 700 kids are going to be doing this week through initiative here. She forgot to mention Julie Leary, so she wants to thank Julie Leary, the librarian who's working with all the kids over at Harborview. So on the line right now, we have Lisa Way. She is from Search, and she's here to talk about some winter injury prevention. Hi there. How are you today, Lisa?
I'm good. How are you, Joan? Thanks
good.
For having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So let's talk a little bit about this Be Safe, Be Seen issue.
Okay, so what we're doing is we're providing reflective tape to put on your clothing, your outerwear, so that cars can see you from about 500 feet. It's really nice and reflective and bright, and it really is so much better than wearing even just a bright color for us at night. We have the tape that we provide that sticks really well to fleece and to rain gear, and it actually, you can wash it a few times, it will still stick to your clothing. And then for the little kids, we have a whole bunch of Safe Routes to School zipper poles provided to us from the state.
Great.
That's the school program.
And how do people get them?
They can call me. My phone number is 907-966-8804, or they can email me if they would like, and it's lesaw@search.org, and that's SEARHC.
Okay, and you're based in Sitka, so you just pop them in the mail?
Yep, I do. That's perfect.
That sounds great. And any other advice you want to give us as far as staying safe during the winter months?
Well, the other thing that we want to think about, too, is making sure we put lots of reflective tape and stuff on our bikes, because I know a lot of us like to use non-motorized transportation to move around when it's not AC and snowy, and so that's the other thing to think about. And then also, if you're out walking around, make sure you have some traction stuff for your feet. Falling is a big issue right now, and we just like people to be safe when they're out there enjoying our winter sports.
Okay, let's talk about that. So when you say traction, what are you talking about specifically?
The most common one is yak tracks. You pull them on the outside of your shoes. They're rubber, and they have like a metal spring around them that kind of gives you some really good traction. The other things that are out there, there's these little things called ice bugs that you can take a pair of shoes that you wear normally and stick in some spikes in the bottom of your shoes so that they have real good traction on the ice.
Okay. And now those yak tracks, I've used them. They're really easy. You put them on, and then you use them, and then when you don't need them anymore, you just take them off. Usually I bring like a little Ziploc and I just throw them in my bag because they're usually pretty wet and gravelly and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yucky.
Okay.
The thing that we're thinking about for elders, and we're doing a little bit of research here in Sitka, there's this new ice grippies that are over boots. Elders have a really hard time pulling those yak tracks on their shoes. And sometimes they tend to get a size too big, so they don't stay on their shoes very well. So we're just giving this a shot and seeing if we can't find another option for them that it's a little easier to pull over their shoes.
Okay, that sounds good. And then also, what about this helmets while ice skating? I have a note here that you want to talk about that as well.
Yeah, well, traumatic brain injury is kind of a big word that we're talking about in injury prevention. They're finding that even minor concussions, something you wouldn't normally take your child to a clinic to see, but if they get more than one injury, that they're finding that those injuries cause traumatic brain injury. It's kind of like bruising your brain. And so we're encouraging parents, especially of little kids that are learning how to skate, to put a bike helmet. They also make skating helmets for them. But they're kind of expensive, and we don't get as much skating as, say, if you were a hockey player. So you wouldn't get a lot of use out of it. So we're just encouraging parents to put some little their bike helmets on them during the winter.
Okay, so you're saying that if you're going to, for Junoites, if you're going to head out to Twin Lakes or the glacier when it's nice and cold, you would just grab that bike helmet and put it on your kid as they're off just skating outside.
A little extra precaution, yeah.
Okay, so to wrap it up, there's this Be Safe, Be Seen initiative being taken care of. Search is doing this Be Safe, Be Seen initiative, and they're issuing reflective tape and little zipper pulls for school-age children, and to get this material. You could call 966-8804 in Sitka. Or what's that email again for you, Lisa?
It's lesaw@search.org.
Great. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Juno Afternoon, and you still are. It's December 9th, and you're listening on KTOO News. Juno, if you've heard anything or if you missed anything, you could always go to ktoo.org and listen to any of the programming at any time. I'm Joan Pardis. I'm your Monday host. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show. He is at the board. One more time, Eagle Crest. Powder Magazine has this big ski town throwdown going on, and Eagle Crest is a finalist. It ends Friday at 4. You could vote every 24 hours. You could find out all the details at the Eagle Crest website, which just search Eagle Crest website and you will get it. Here, as far as the weather tonight, it's rain and snow likely in the evening, snow likely late, snow accumulation to 1 inch, lows around 29. Tuesday, snow in the morning, rain in the afternoon, snow accumulation 1 to 2 inches, snow level 700 feet in the afternoon, highs around 35, southeast wind 10 miles per hour. Tuesday night, rain and snow accumulation 1 to 3 inches, highest amounts from Mendenhall Valley north, lows 30 to 34. Wednesday, rain and snow, Wednesday night, rain and snow, Thursday, snow, highs 28 to 34, Thursday night, snow likely, Friday, snow likely, Friday night, snow and rain. Okay, tonight at 7 on KTOO, a special intelligence squared debate. Does domestic spying keep us safe? The NSA collects data on billions of phone calls and internet communications per day. Are these surveillance programs legal? Do they keep us safe? Whether you believe leakers are heroes or traitors, an important public conversation has finally begun, and we should ask ourselves, what trade-offs are we willing to make between security and privacy? So that's tonight at 7 p.m. on KTOO, a special intelligence squared debate. Tomorrow, Pat Moore is on Juno Afternoon. He will be talking about Wednesday's mudroom. George Brown will be in the studio to talk about Wednesday's screening of Escape Fire, a film about healthcare. Thunder Mountain's high school softball team will be here, and much, much more. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas.